to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Willis.
Yes.
What is today? November. Oh, I got it right today. November 17th. I put the page together almost always. I put Saturday's date instead of Sunday's date. What the heck is wrong with me? So what are we, 10 days into Trump's Great America? Maybe. Did have somebody, might have been a neighbor, said that my Trump flag was an atrocity. Take it down.
Take it down.
It is an atrocity. Which, I don't know, I kind of thought was funny. I contemplated leaving it up forever. And, well, you know, thought better of it. Didn't want to be a complete pain. But anyway, it's kind of exciting. There's a lot happening, and it hasn't even started yet. So we're looking forward to that. Thought it made sense to have Fred Dasmalchi and Hamid Azimi back with us. We have done programs with them about Iran in the past, but gosh, and I listed them. Where did I list them? We started doing shows way back, August of 2015. So we have been doing shows with these guys for a long time. We've only done a few, but they are part of the Organization of Iranian American Communities. And it's just, I think it's something that maybe we don't know a lot about. I think most Americans don't follow this very closely. It's kind of like Iran bad. But there's a whole community within the outside, well, and inside, I guess, both inside and outside their country, that really is looking to promote freedom and get back to the values they had before. They're kind of captives at the moment. Hamid Azimi is the communications director for the Iranian American Community of Northern California. It's IAC NorCal, and I've got the links up there for their Facebook page and Twitter. That I just don't like calling X because, I don't know, it just seems like Twitter to me.
It's X.
I don't seem to be able to modernize. And Fred I see all the time. I just saw him a couple weeks ago. He's a resident of Sacramento, has been a human rights activist for over 30 years. He was arrested once in 1980 in the city of Mossad. After that, he was forced to leave the country. He increased his human rights activities to be the voice of the people in his country. He's been active in his community, mobilizing the Islamic community in Sacramento against Islamic fundamentalism in Iran. And he's a good friend of ours, and we see him regularly. And they had an event yesterday. I posted that as well. It was the Rally for Free Iran. It was everywhere, so I'll let them tell us all about it. But I did post the flyer for it. So if you were thinking that this is a one-dimensional thing, actually be prepared to be impressed. There's a whole nother side to this. So I don't know where you guys would like to start, but...
Well, let's start with our hellos and appreciation to you and Bill for having us on the program again.
Oh, sure.
And you're absolutely right. There's a lot to talk about, and we are honored to be guests of your show for this.
We're really... really happy to give you the time. This isn't something that lends itself to a 2-minute interview. It kind of has to be explained. So we have not spoken with you. I cannot believe this, but when I was putting the page together yesterday, April of 2022, a lot has happened since April of 2022. So I don't know how much you want to start forward and go back, or go back and come forward, or you tell us.
Well, I guess let Fred say hello to you, and then we'll tackle this. Fred, go ahead.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you so much for inviting us. It's an honor to be, you know, with you today, and I hope it will be helpful today. And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We, you know, this platform lends itself well to things that have to be explained kind of in long form. So we really appreciate you guys making the time on a Sunday afternoon to come on and educate us. A lot of times we see the world through a very narrow lens, and I don't believe our we'll call it news, but I think we all have other assessments for that. I think our news doesn't always do a very good job of giving us a full picture. So we really, we're really looking forward to hearing what you guys have to tell us about all of this.
I appreciate that, Aaron. And let me just start by a little general background on what we call the Iranian resistance. the movement in Iran by the people who have taken to the streets in, gosh, I think it's been 7 nationwide uprisings in the last 6-7 years. And this is a nation that is, or a country, I should say, that is situated right in the middle of a lot of things that are happening around it in the Middle East. Geopolitically, it's a piece of land that throughout the history, a lot of, you know, fight has been over it and control over it, mostly by the dictators, has been, you know, the topic of a lot of back and forth in the international arena. Fast forward to where we are right now, the Iranian regime rose up in 1979 so that they could get rid of a monarchic dictatorship. The last Shah of Iran was toppled, and more than anything, because of the dictatorship, because all of the, you know, elite and progressive students were imprisoned by the dictator, by the last Shah. And because that very last Shah of Iran was providing a lot of support for the Ayatollahs, for the religious people in the country, it ended up that those same religious leaders who, and I should not even, you know, call the religious leader, the fundamentalists, the Islamic fundamentalists that were in the corner of mosques back then in Iran, they had a lot of support from the system. And when the revolution happened, lo and behold, they were the pretty much the only group that had the organization and the internal network to take over the revolution. And they did that immediately after 1979 revolution. They managed to start their own army, which is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It doesn't even have the name of Iran after it, because they believe that the fundamentalists, that they own everything in the world and they need to destroy everything and take over. So the people of Iran ended up being at the center of an Islamic fundamentalist movement that started back then. If you look back, a lot of countries started having these backward Islamic fundamentalist movements in them. And fast forward right now, you know, going the 2 years back or a year and a half back, we see that the same talk of fundamentalism is wreaking havoc in the Middle East, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis in Yemen, and on and on and on. They are causing a lot of problems. And when it comes to what we have been talking about, you mentioned, Aaron, that the first talk with our group started in 2015. And I know back then, we, and right now, we have been talking about what is the alternative to the Ayatollahs. Is there a group, an Iranian group, that is ready, capable, willing to pay the price and bring about democracy in Iran, so that when we in the West, you know, imagine a Middle East that the Ayatollahs are not there anymore, and in Iran there is a democratic system which is not at war with everybody, which does not want to destroy any country in the Middle East, which wants to abolish the death penalty and abide by all the international laws. We've been talking about for many years about the alternative, which is the National Council of Resistance of Iran. As you mentioned, the mainstream media doesn't talk about it a whole lot because, you know, the policy in the West has been appeasing the Ayatollahs and not punishing the Ayatollahs for what they have done. And we can you know, talk about this appeasement for hours and give examples, but in a general term.
Well, Hamid, for those people, it occurs to me that for those folks who really don't know, because I remember we didn't really know, before the fundamentalists took over, kind of what did your, we've got like 3 minutes before the break, but kind of a snapshot of what the country looked like before. Because I remember just being so surprised. I guess I never took any history of that part of the world or anything beyond where the countries were located. But we didn't really look into what was going on in those places. How did the country function before these guys showed up?
Well, on that subject, if we are going to break in 3 minutes, I would need more time.
I know. We can come back with it after,
right.
But...
Yeah, let's come back to it. Let me just finish this, this first segment by just going, you know, finishing up the thoughts about the alternative to the Ayatollahs, because right now we can definitely go back and talk about how it was before. But right now, the Iranian issue, which was the Iranian people's issue with the Ayatollah, has become everybody's issue right now, especially post October 7th of last year. And everybody knows that we need to deal with it. And the alternative, which is the National Council of Resistance of Iran, led by a woman, Maryam Rajavi. She is in exile in Paris. And she is, ironically, the person who, in the Parliament of Europe, if I'm not mistaken, in 2015, warned the entire world that the danger of the Ayatollahs is not their nuclear bomb danger. The danger is their involvement in the Middle East spreading fundamentalism. Back then, I know we had talked about it in your show before, and we have been talking about it for many years. And up until, you know, October 7th, the world did not realize that the danger of the Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran is not necessarily just, you know, the regime getting their hand on the atomic bomb. I mean, they need to be stopped, and people of Iran will stop them with toppling the regime. But the world is now realizing that the main danger is the spread of Islamic fundamentalism and what the Iranian regime refers to as the export of revolution that they have done, which is basically export of their type of backward Islamic fundamentalism that is ruining the Middle East right now and has spread into other parts of the world, including South America.
And that seems to be where we all really tuned in. News of the world has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And now we have a lot more sources, some good, some bad. But we have things from inside those countries, outside those countries. We have a lot wider vantage point. The problem is we don't always know what happened before. So context is missing oftentimes. And I think that if we all went out and asked people, hey, did you know that there was a revolutionary group inside Iran that wants to get rid of the mullahs and fix things and be a democracy? People would be like, what?
Yeah, most people don't know.
They would not know, which is terrible. And that's why I think it's really important that you have rallies and things inside this country. And I know we'll talk about that, too. But I would like to sketch for people kind of what your country looked like. I've looked at before and after pictures, and it's amazing, and it's got to be heartbreaking for all of you. We will be right back with our guests. Hamid Azimi and Fred Dasmalchi. We are talking about the people of Iran as they rise up for freedom. You're here at We the People Radio, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, now back to the real Iran. What did it really look like before?
Well, before the 1979 revolution, we were under a different type of dictatorship. And that type of dictatorship was the monarchy, the Shah's dictatorship. When people looked at how it was, they saw a country that was going through being catapulted from the agrarian or the land lords to capitalism. That in itself, you know, when we look at how societies in the Middle East should be evolving, that's definitely one of the more common paths, that, you know, the landlords, you know, go to automation, and through the process of natural evolution of the society, they evolve into capitalism. But what happened in Iran was that the Shah basically, with the help of foreign powers, including the Kennedy and then the administrations after that, managed to topple the government of an Iranian nationalist called Mohammad Mossadegh. In 1953, he had nationalized Iranian oil, taken the oil out of the control of the British, and wanted to have a democracy in the Middle East with the type of national capitalism that our country needed to have. And he was the person who was basically leading Iran into its national growth into capitalism. But what happened with the 1953 coup d'etat, and then after that with Shah traveling to Washington and receiving instructions from President Kennedy that he needs to do a land reform, the type it was done in South America, to basically push everything to capitalism. But that in itself was, in Iran, was not the right path for the country. It was too soon, and it basically ruined our agriculture, forced millions of people who lived in the villages where there was or agricultural fields that they were taking care of, or agriculture, into big cities, forcing them to become factory workers for the new capitalist system. And because of that push, because of that untimely push, our agriculture got destroyed, and there was, in the society, there was signs of modernism, but underneath that facade, people were not happy with what was going on, and dissent started at that point. Shah's answer was building prisons. The two of the most vicious prisons that we have in the capital, Evin Prison and Ghazal Hisar Prison, which are the, you know, torture places for the kids right now in Iran, were built by the Shah to control the population. And that was pretty much the start of, you know, the new wave of dictatorship he had. He ended up canceling or abolishing the two parties that both of them were loyal to him. He abolished both of the political parties and started a single party system in Iran. And that added to the problems that people had with him. So when people look at Iran prior to 1979 revolution, they see the signs of a society that has been pushed into capitalism. They see a society that seems like it is doing okay, but they don't see the fact that at the same time, Iran had become a single party system. There was no other parties allowed to become a voice of any type of opposition to the Shah. And that, again, was one of the main reasons that people were fed up with his regime and his system, and they ended up, you know, revolting against him and putting a definite end to monarchy in Iran, which carried on to, you know, last couple of years, especially 2 years ago when we had Mahsa Amini uprising in Iran. One of the main chants that people had was that down with the oppressor, be it the Shah or the leader, referring to the current leader of Iran.
Yeah, and when you look, like, from the outside looking in, when you look just at pictures of women in the pre-revolution time and now, I mean, they just wore regular clothes like we do back then, and now there's
absolutely. But what those pictures do not show, Aaron.
Yeah, no,
both women, either in, you know, with no hair covering and with Western clothing, and the ones that we see with, you know, the so-called Islamic clothing, they are both suffering under a single-party system in a country that deserves to have democracy.
Right. Well, and it's got to be, I mean, it's got to be extremely difficult to fight them from inside Iran, but from outside, you're a worldwide movement. Like, your big conference is always, maybe they're just the ones that Fred sends me email about, but aren't they usually, like, in Paris? Or was that just one?
No, they are. Let me let Fred take that one, please.
Before that, I would like to mention about my experience during the Shah time. I mean, of course, the economy was doing better compared to what we have right now. I mean, there was some improvement, but overall, you know, it was a dictatorship. And I remember in 1975, I was a student in India, Iranian student in India. And that time, you know, the Savak was very powerful in Iran. And when I was in India, we have a demonstration against Iranian government, and practically Indian government let us as a foreign student to cover our face and attend demonstration, because we didn't be identified by the Savage. And that Savage was causing a lot of fear during the short time. And then what happened, President Carter, you know, he was pushing, and like 2-3 years before revolution, he was pushing for reform in Iran again, and asked Shah to not to push, you know, not to stop the Savage. But what didn't realize that by you know, 2 years before revolution, by not having Savage that strong, that is going to cause vacuum and start uprising. And once the practically Shah stopped torturing, you know, stopped in the prison, that caused especially in the movement start from the students actually against the Shah. And then from the student, you know, it went to the other cities, you know, because when they go back to the student, they went back to their cities and then practically become more active. And then practically in that time, people, they want to have a better system. But unfortunately, what happened, the mullah people, this religion people, they have a lot of freedom during the short time. And there was so much practically money during the short time was investing to give more vote for these mullah people, and they are the one who practically control the, you know, practically they hijack the revolution. And so, you know, people, they fight for democracy, but supreme leader, you know, in that time, you know, it was Khomeini, and practically he changed everything. And then practically he go forward, and then this is what we have right now. And I just want to mention, this is also, but this is what I saw, you know, what during the short time.
Now it's important for that perspective, because otherwise it's easy to believe that things have been the same just since it's a little bit like coming in late in a movie. You know, we tuned in late and we think it was always like it is now, and that's just not true.
Go Hamid, thank you.
I broke the show, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Come back, Hamid, come back, save me.
So I think going back to what you asked about our movement being a international one, Let's just focus on that you're absolutely right. Outside Iran, we have an international organized movement that is working to basically form the policies, the right policies in the West. The policies of, you know, closing eyes on the atrocities that are going on in Iran, which we call the appeasement policy. This is not the right policy. This is a policy that did not work for the entire world when, you know, British were appeasing Hitler, thinking that he's going to sit back and there's not going to be any war, and the world ended up with a world war. It's the same type of mistake that the West is making in trying to control and appease the Ayatollahs. Inside Iran, however, there is a huge resistance movement that is leading everything. Our work outside the country is introducing the alternative to the Ayatollahs, not only in the form of the National Council of Resistance, led by a woman, Mrs. Rajavi, and the plan that she has. And I appreciate you having put her plan on the website. It's a 10-point plan that, you know, General James Jones, a 4-star, you know, military person of U.S. Army, has called repeatedly a Jeffersonian plan for Iran. So the everything that we're doing is for the movement that is actually taking place inside Iran. Inside Iran, the young generation mostly, with the help of, you know, the activists from all ages have been organizing themselves in terms of what we call resistance units. You know, people, you know, everybody is heard of the resistance movement in France when they got rid of, you know, their dictators. And in Iran, we have the same type of thing. These are people who are getting together, forming small units that are getting ready to form the uprisings that will eventually topple the regime inside Iran. And these are the kind of things that are also happening in the Middle East, in the most important, or I should say the most critical country, one of the largest in that area with vast amount of oil and gas, with control over the Persian Gulf and all of those things that your listeners probably will just know by looking at the map. This country has its own resistance movement inside the country. It is a totally different picture from what the world had seen, let's say in Iraq or Afghanistan, where there wasn't an organized resistance inside. The difference is that with Iran, as we have said in our movement for many, many years, there is no need to send money or weapons for the people in Iran. They have their own might and will to take care of things. What is missing is not sending foreign boots to Iran. It's actually supporting the local boots on the streets, a resistance unit that are formed by Iran's main opposition group, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, which is known mostly in the social media as the Persian acronym MEK, Mujahideen Khalq, MEK. These resistance units that the MEK has inside Iran, they are the one that need the support. They are the one that need the political support more than anything else.
Hamid, weren't they? Hasn't the MEK been demonized over the years as the bad guys? Weren't they cast as the? I seem to remember this from before. We had had a conversation, and our government was trying to say that they were
I think they were on the terror watch list.
Yeah, weren't they the bad? They were being we were being told they were the bad guys.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the Bill Clinton administration, that Iran had elected a president. It wasn't an election because there's under dictatorships there is no election.
They
had selected a new president, and his name was Khatami, and he was leading the so-called reform in Iran. You know, the same problem that we had for many, many years, that the West thought that, oh, there might be a reformist within,
right,
within Iranian government, within all of these Islamic fundamentalism, there might be a reformer.
Right, an Islamic fundamentalist reformer, that's kind of funny.
I mean, exactly. It's like the giant shrimp, right?
Yeah. Is that I like that. That's fun.
Yeah.
On that happy note, I'm sorry I don't have a song about a shrimp or I'd play it. we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
No problem. We'll continue after the break.
With Hamid and Fred. Ponder that giant shrimp while you're thinking about it.
Ooh. can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing it.
So, back to the reasonable and well-organized and magnanimous Islamic fundamentalist reformers.
This is the Fred. I would like to add one more item to the resistance unit. Before, you know, Hamid explained about the resistance units, but also in Iran, the women are the leader, actually, right now for this uprising. And the reason is also this Islamic fundamentalists, they put so much pressure on the women as a second citizen. And that's why, you know, they become the leader and they got so much energy. And I think there is a good chance that this revolution goes through. It will be the first time, I think, the women are making revolution. And it makes sense because there is the women, they need more freedom in that area, you know, because of what's happening to them. And the good news is about also resistance units, you know, over time, the uprising happening, they are realizing they are not gaining anything from the Iranian regime, Iranian government. Therefore, they become more radical and more radical, and that's why they are forming more resistance units. And besides, not only resistance units, they are training themselves, they are connecting with each other, they are making very, very strong networks because they know for them to be able to function against the Islamic Guard, they need to be also very organized, very connection, and very much using all the experience they have from the past and to use it to practically to the next uprising as coming practical. I just want to add to Hamid's comment regarding to the resistance units in Iran.
So are we at the part where you can tell us about your events here? I don't know what your roadmap for us is. We've got plenty of time.
Yeah, so let me just go ahead and finish what we were talking about before the break, that it was the Bill Clinton administration that got excited about the prospect of reform in Iran, and what they did, they, at the request of the newly selected president in Iran, they put the movement, the MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq, and it was our movement on the terrorist list, and it took us 15 years, if I'm not mistaken, to take the case to the court of law in United States and have the courts order the government to remove this movement. So this was the depth of the appeasement policy and how far it went in not allowing, you know, the people of Iran to have their own fate and be able to make the regime change that they need to do. And we are seeing changes, as we talked about it before, that after October 7th, things are moving in a different direction, and people are realizing throughout different administrations in all countries that there is no place for the Iranian regime in the world anymore. And as I mentioned, the little by little, what we are trying to do through the rallies that we had yesterday, and we'll get to that too in a minute, is to send this message to everybody that look at all of the uprisings in Iran. Look at how yesterday was the fifth anniversary of the 2019 nationwide uprising in Iran. When we look at all of the news coverage by the Iranian regime during that uprising, there is a lot of indication that the regime came very close to getting collapsed. It was the beginning of a nationwide uprising that was led by the resistance units inside Iran, the MEK resistance units inside Iran. And there were talks of, you know, 1,000 different points of fighting back and forth between people and the repressive forces throughout Iran, showing the fact that the movement in Iran was ready, is ready, and capable of making the change. But just the fact that it did not become the 5 o'clock news in U.S. shows that the policies that were governing the mainstream media did not want everybody to know that, you know what, in Iran there are kids in the street, they are fighting their own fight, and they want to topple the regime and bring about a democratic system. Let's support them. That did not happen. And that is the big thing that is missing in the picture for the Iranian people. Just the fact that people are not realizing. So our rallies, like the one that happened yesterday in San Francisco, they had the same sister organizations in Southern California. They had the same kind of thing in Santa Monica. There are sister organizations in Washington, D.C. also had one in front of the White House. And everybody was basically chanting the same chants and asking the same thing, that it is time for the civilized world to stop appeasing the Ayatollahs, take some action through international bodies like United Nations to put some pressure on Iran to stop the massive wave of executions. Iran has selected a new president, and in the last 4 months, you know, his first 100 days of being in the office, there has been over 460 executions in Iran. Wow. At least, as far as I know, 15 were women. Now, these are horrible, horrible data that is coming out of Iran. And when we hear that, you know, the current administration is talking about, you know, going back to the negotiations table with the same regime, worried about, you know, whether or not they're going to have a nuclear bomb, which is a valid worry. But it's not the right policy. And our events, our rallies are basically pointing out the facts about Iran, pointing facts about the fact that Iranian boots are on the streets. We need to support them so that we can prevent sending foreign boats to Iran to get rid of this evil regime.
Were the 400 executions you're talking about, were they all political executions?
Not necessarily. Some of them are for other so-called crimes, but most of them are political ones. Mm-hmm. And that's, these kind of executions are not really the extent of the atrocities that are going on. And in the same country that it is, there's so much corruption that the government is left and right announcing billions of dollars that are being embezzled by its own throughout Iran, and there are quite a few number of billion-dollar embezzlements going on. A couple of weeks ago, two brothers who are from the Kurdistan region of Iran, they had their four right-hand fingers cut off they were caught for some petty theft. And international bodies, you know, made statements about it, you know, condemned it, and so on and so forth. But these kind of things have been going on in Iran for four decades. You know, the vicious form of punishment like this has been going on in Iran for many years. And one of the points that we want to make across to the governments is that you should not sit down and talk with people like this. When people are in the street shaking their lives and chanting death to the dictator, I give my life for Iran, those are the kind of things that should be supported. And at the moment, they have not been supported amply, and there hasn't been, especially in the last 4 years, has not been, you know, the proper maximum pressure that needs to be put on the Ayatollahs. Yeah.
And another factor also, most of the execution also is from the Kurdish area. With the Kurdish area, they have, you know, for a long time, they have a problem. There's a lot of uprising in that area. And also from the east side, Baluchis also. For the high percentage of the execution from these two areas. And also, if you look at the age-wise, the execution, usually Iranian government, they focus on the young people because that's when they want to cause more fear. Therefore, there is a list for them, therefore, as they need, therefore, they start executing. Sometimes, it's average about 4.5 per day, but sometimes in 3 days, they execute 35 people within 3 days. I mean, the way they do it, they just want to cause more fear, practically.
So, the resistance fighters, we talked about not really needing boots on the ground and so forth. Are they getting any support from other nations, or are they pretty much in this alone?
No, they are pretty much in this alone, Bill. And they have the support of 80 million Iranians inside Iraq, right? So by nature, these resistance units are groups of people that are basically getting organized and getting ready to fight their internal enemies. And they live in the neighborhood that people know that they are part of their resistance units. And if anybody, you know, searches the resistance units in Europe, it's the same kind of things that, you know, people know who they are, people support them, people give them help, and that's exactly why and how they can take actions inside different cities in Iran pretty much in daylight and in the, you know, observation of people that are living in that neighborhood. One point in case that I bring up a lot is, you might remember the Iranian IRGC external group, the Quds Force in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani was his name. He was taken out in one of his trips in Iraq by President Trump's administration. And it was a huge blow to the Ayatollahs. It derailed a lot of things that the Ayatollahs did in the Middle East. And, of course, the Ayatollahs wanted to make a national hero from him. So in one of the cases, they made a 2-meter, which is like 6-7 feet tall statue of him, and they put it in the one of the roundabouts in a major city in, if I'm not mistaken, it was in southern part of Iran.
Guys, we have to jump off for the news here. Terribly sorry, but we will be
no problem.
Right,
we'll continue
back
after the news.
Be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio.
.us.
Today is November 17th, 2024. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, how's it going today, Bill?
Hey, you know what? Not too bad. It's not raining. It's cool and cloudy, and I like it.
And Trump is the incoming president.
Oh.
And let's just bring that up one more time.
Yeah.
Yep. If you want to know about my atrocity flag, I'll put a picture of it online. Just said Trump fans 2024. It was kind of a happy little banner, actually. I thought it was kind of lovely. I was planning on leaving it there all year, but apparently the neighbors had other ideas.
Yep. They were not impressed.
Yep, you have the Holocaust and then you have the Trump flag. Both atrocities. I was like, wow, really? Talk about clueless. So we're talking about actual real issues affecting people beyond my Trump flag. We're chatting with Hamid Azimi and Fred Dasmalchi, and they are part of a group of in the Iranian American community of Northern California. And I was just going to read this little blurb, or Hamid, you know what? I'm not going to read the blurb. I'll just mess it up. How about this? Give people the overview of what your organization does, the OIAC.
Sure. So the Iranian American Community of Northern California, we are part of a general big group of 40 somewhat different organizations throughout the United States. And we've been around in Northern California at least for the last three decades. And we have been promoting a democratic change in Iran, and we have been supporting and do support the alternative to the Ayatollahs. The alternative is the National Council of Resistance of Iran. It is led by a woman who is in exile in Paris. Her name is Maryam Rajavi. And our organization is basically trying to promote the right policy about Iran and in dealing with Iran. Iran has very clearly become the problem for the world. It was our problem for a long while. Now everybody in the world knows that the Iranian regime, with the way they have been spreading Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism in the Middle East and in the world, need to be changed. Everybody is concerned that what the force of change is. The force of change is not war, is not foreign boots on the ground in Iran. The force of change is the Iranian boots on the ground in Iran, and they are the organized resistance movement in Iran. They are the resistance units that have formed over the last years, and they are fighting the regime in Iran, and the policy needs to be set to recognize the right for confronting the dictators in Iran, and that's the way to do it, and that is what we have been talking about and promoting through the activities of our organization.
So before we get back to the information part of this, how could people support your organization? Like those of us that are not super well versed in this, and we don't have ties to your country or relatives there. How would other people help you guys out?
Right, so we've been trying to use the democratic tools that are available to us in this country, and we love it and enjoy it. And one of the things that we have been doing is working with the members of Congress to bring about resolutions and legislation that sets the policy and forces the executive branch, and you know, beating around the bush to get the executive branch to set the right policy. And we have been fortunate that through our activities with the members of the House throughout the years, we have had a number of resolutions in the House of Representatives and in the Senate supporting the fact that we just talked about, supporting the fact that the people of Iran have the right to confront the dictators. And your listeners might be surprised that we have to do this. It's, you know, we have to get legislation for our God-given right to pick up arms and fight the dictator. Unfortunately, because of the policies of appeasement, this very natural right for the people of Iran is not recognized by the governments. And that is the biggest thing that is missing in the policy, that the policy of the United States should clearly be support for the people of Iran and their God-given right to confront their dictators. And the way listeners can help is pick up the phone and call their representative. They need to call Representative Lamalfa. He's already on board, and he has supported the resolution in the current House of Representatives, House Resolution 1148, which has the majority support in the House of Representatives. But my suggestion for listeners, you know, from anywhere they're calling, go online, look it up, and if your representative has not agreed with the fact that people of Iran have the right to confront their dictators, give them a call as a constituent and tell them, let's do this. This is the way to prevent sending our boots to the streets of Iran and, you know, support the Iranian boots that are already on the ground.
Yeah, because typically it's send us money, weapons, and soldiers. And I know in previous conversations, it has been, please stop sending money. You know, please stop funding the efforts inside Iran to oppress people.
You know, Aaron, I agree with you. One of the things, you know, we would like to see that we go back to the policy of maximum sanction, you know, maximum pressure against the Iranian government. Because the Iranian government, all the money, you know, practically they are getting by selling oil to China, they're using proxies practically. And that's why it's very important, you know, for the new administration, you know, to go back to what they had before and put maximum pressure on the Iranian government. And I think that's really helping also. And my friend Hamid mentioned about House Resolution 1148. I would like to say thank you also to Congressman Doug Lamalfa for supporting this resolution. This resolution is very, very important because, as my friend mentioned, we have about 227 members, bipartisan, they support this resolution. But this resolution, it came after October 7th. And, you know, after October 7th, we have more than 15 resolutions about Iran, the different sanctions, and all those resolutions is very good. But this resolution, 1148, has got one, the one element that is different to the others is that practically is mentioning that the Iranian people, they want to change the government by politically supporting Iranian people and morally supporting Iranian people. And the, when the Iranian people, they change this government, that will be the best solution for Middle East. And that is the opportunity to bring a peace to Middle East, because since you have the Iranian government and they're using all the resources for this proxy, they're not going to let practically have a solution for that area. Even two-state solution is not going to work when Iranian government is against that and expending all this money. Therefore, practically, like this resolution 1148 is showing, you know, what's the best solution for that area, and practically is focusing on the head of the snake, which is Iranian government and Iranian supreme leader. As you know, if we follow up the news regarding to that, you know, in October 7th, when happened, at the first 2-3 months, the supreme leader of Iranian government, they said, oh, these are the resistance of the area that are fighting against Israel, and because we are not involved. But over time, it's showing that, no, this is the Iranian government. They are the head of the snake. They are the one causing all this problem. Therefore, this resolution 1148, it shows that they are supporting moral support, the Iranian people. That practically give a chance for peace to that area.
Nice. And I will post that on the site for today. People can just click on the congress.gov link on there, and you can see, you can follow who the co-sponsors are. There are 27 of them listed, and you'll be able to see, is your member of the House supporting that? It's really important to be on the right side of this particular issue, especially with everything that's going on. It's easy for people to say, oh, you know, these guys are all bad, doing bad things. It's like, well, the world is a little more nuanced than that.
I mean, the Iranian government right now, Hamid, you agree with me, they're at the weakest situation compared to last 42, 45 years. You know, if you look at all the elements, the Iranian inflation rate is very, very high right now. Economy is not doing good. They have a big problem in their hand in Middle East by through the proxies, which they are very much, they are in their big problem, and also internationally. Therefore, this is a good time, I think, for the Iranian people. I think the Iranian people, they realize that the government is getting weaker, Iranian government is getting weaker and weaker, and hopefully we'll have another uprising. And then this resolution 1148 also is mentioning to supporting the resistance units that they have the right to defend the Iranian people during the uprising against the Islamic Guard, and practically they need it. Practically that's what is very important, to recognize the resistance units also, which is, that's what this resolution is important.
Good to know, and that it's always nice for people to be able to actually do something. It's one thing to hear all about it, but then you feel like, well, what can I do? At the very least, bring that information. And Hamid, you do a tremendous amount of public speaking, don't you?
I try to do my share, and I want to focus on one of the things that you just mentioned, Aaron, about, you know, the fact that what is happening in the Middle East, what is happening in Iran, really does have an effect on us living in Northern California. The world has really become a small village, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the old expression came to mind that what does this discussion have to do with the price of tea in China, right? So what does this discussion have to do with people living in, you know, the first congressional district in California? And I think what we have seen, what we have witnessed in the last year or so, specifically after October 7th and what started in Gaza and the aftermath in Lebanon, and what the Iranian regime, as Fred mentioned, was eventually have to show its role in everything, and everybody realizing that, yeah, if the prospect of war in the Middle East is sending our grocery prices up, it's sending our, you know, gasoline prices up, and marketplace is getting affected by it, and, you know, the prospect of Iranian regime closing down the, you know, the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf so that the oil tankers cannot pass through the all of these things, you know, they are having their direct effect on our farmers in California. They have their direct effect on, you know, the working class here that has to pay the extra price for the gallon of milk and a gallon of, you know, gasoline just because we do not have peace and tranquility in the Middle East. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk today, for many years we knew and we understood that the problem that we had in Iran was primarily an Iranian problem. The Ayatollahs, the Islamic fundamentalism ruining our country was for a while our own problem. But right now it is everybody's problem. And the good news is that our nation is ready, is willing, is capable of doing what it's supposed to do to bring about democratic change in Iran, to bring about peace to the Middle East. And what is missing, if I may repeat myself, just like a broken record, is the right policy. And I appreciate you posting the link to the House Resolution 1148. This needs to get on the floor and get, you know, into a bill and become the law of the nation that, yes, United States of America as a nation is supporting people of Iran in their quest for regime change in their own hands.
Yeah. Do you think the...
Bill, sanctions. We have to go to a break.
Oh.
You're getting cut off at the pass.
All right, we'll talk about sanctions when we come back.
It's Bill's job to remember what we're talking about when we come back. I'm probably going to forget. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Let's talk about sanctions. You know, we hear a lot about that, and I just do you think they have a positive effect on Iran and particularly the resistance fighters? I mean, does it hurt them as much as it hurts the regime?
So, great question, Bill. So, the type of sanctions that we saw under Trump administration, which was dubbed as the maximum pressure, what they were doing, they were preventing the Iranian regime to freely sell its oil and be able to buy arms through the black market and also send money to its proxies in the Middle East to prevent it to send money to Lebanon and to Yemen, to the Houthis, and what have you. The people in Iran, we talked about, or I talked about, the corruption in the system and how within the government there are numerous cases of billion-dollar embezzlements in different areas of, you know, economy in Iran. Any area that you touch, there has been at least one major $1 billion, if not $100 million, hundreds of millions of dollars embezzlement.
Wow.
So people in Iran are suffering not because of the sanctions. They're suffering because of the corrupt government that they have. Sanctions does not, you know, affect the average person in the street in terms of, you know, the way they are suffering under this dictatorship. Sanctions, however, do affect the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. It affects the way the government can function freely all the way in our neighborhood in southern, you know, South America. And they are spending, they have been spending billions and billions throughout the Middle East and throughout the world to spread, you know, their type of dictatorship that they have, their type of Islamic fundamentalism. It's that type of money that they end up having in their hand that can hire, you know, murderers for hire. Right here in the United States, it was in the news a couple of weeks ago that the FBI has pulled a plot by the Iranian regime that they wanted to pay someone to assassinate President Trump here, right here in the United States. So what sanctions had done in the past and will do in the future is, with, you know, the right targeting, with the right policy of maximum pressure on the regime, will actually help the people of Iran. But keep in mind, there has been a real war going on inside Iran between the people and the government that rules them. Sanctions will put pressure on the dictators and very naturally, by its nature, will help the people and not make them suffer.
Okay.
And Bill, I would like to add one thing to Hamid's comment regarding the sanction also, that sanction the price sanction is really works against the Iranian government. And also, but also the good thing about Iran is there are resistant units that they can take that opportunity because and you change it for regime change. Because if you don't have that organization and you don't have that network inside Iran, that sanction by itself is not going to bring regime change. It will be very hard. I mean, we have seen in Iraq, without the forces, you know, the sanction by itself is not going to change the government. But the good news in Iran, there are the resistance units which they are getting stronger and stronger, and in combination of that maximum pressure and resistance units, that is why it's going to be very effective to bring regime change also.
Okay. All right.
It's funny because typically when you hear sanctions, they shy away from it. Where do you think the big change will come between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at this point? Since you guys watch this so closely.
Right. So hopefully what's going to happen is that, Let me go back and start by this. Everybody knows that the Biden administration was not really putting any pressure on the Iranian regime.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pursuing the same old policy of appeasing the Ayatollahs. Even 2 years ago when there were major uprisings in Iran, the Biden administration was not really doing what it's supposed to do, which was siding with the people of Iran and recognizing their right for regime change. If you go back and look at the news, they just kept on, you know, making general statements, which everybody did, but they did not recognize the right of the people that, yeah, you have the right to topple this regime. What we are hoping, and there are ample signs that this will happen, is that the Trump administration will actually go back to putting the maximum pressure on the Iranian regime, which will be a step away from the appeasement policy. And that is a great thing for the people of Iran, because by just stepping away from the appeasement policy, stepping away from closing your eyes to the dictators, the Iranian regime will get the message that the, you know, the world is going to watch, and when the next time people of Iran come to the streets, and it's just a matter of when they we are 100% sure, as they've done in the past, they will come back out and try to topple the regime. And we know this time around, you know, there's going to be a difference in terms of providing the political support to the people that you have the green light. Go ahead and do it. We are not going to, you know, use our mainstream media to shut things down and derail your movement because we want to go back to the negotiations table no matter what. And Iranian regime also recognizes it, that they are going to be dealing with a president that had no hesitation taking out the Iranian master terrorist Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. Everybody knew that the previous administrations knew about this terrorist. They had ample time to take him out. But, you know, just to put it in the layman's term for myself, is that they, you know, they didn't have the backbone to do it. And it happened that President Trump took care of it, eliminated this master terrorist, which was, you know, created waves of happiness and joy in Iraq and in Iran. And the Iranian regime realizes that, you know, the White House is going to be controlled by somebody who will take action. And they will step back, and this will be the positive step for the people of Iran.
Yeah, I remember having that conversation way back when Obama was going to send them just pallets of cash. And I remember you guys saying that if they did that, the executions would increase by a lot. And they did. So I don't.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the wave of executions in Iran, there was a dip in during the Trump administration.
What a surprise.
Yes, there was a dip in, you know, the extraterritorial activities that the Iranian regime had in the Middle East. And with the new administration, you know, because they realized that there's not going to be any major consequences for what they are doing, they went ahead and did whatever heck they wanted. And as Fred mentioned, even during the October 7th mess that they created, they tried to hide themselves. And if it wasn't for the international community to actually put its foot down and say, no, not this time, we're not going to get away with it, they would have hired their role, and things would have been, you know, all over, repeated all over again.
Mm-hmm. That's terrifying. I'm excited. I bet this. So your rallies that you have had this weekend, pretty well attended.
It was, and you know the three rallies that we had in San Francisco, in Santa Monica, and in Washington D.C. was actually part of a 3-day international event that took place, if I'm not mistaken, in 21 different cities throughout Europe, Canada, I know Vancouver, and Toronto had rallies as well. So it was 3 days of going out, supporting the people of Iran, and collectively sending the message to the governments in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe, that it is time to change the appeasement policy, and it is time to recognize the right of the people of Iran to do whatever they need, including picking up arms, to confront their enemy inside Iran and to bring about peace and quiet into the Middle East.
Yeah, I was thinking of you when I got the announcement about your rallies, and I thought, huh, on the heels of this election, I would imagine all of that looks a lot more doable than it did just a couple of weeks ago.
How much resistance do you get from the regime when you have these rallies? Do you hear much from them? Or?
Resistance?
Resistance.
You mean the rallies outside Iran?
No, in the United States, is there anything that you guys, I mean,
right.
Death threats or?
So in the United States, what we are facing is a huge campaign of misinformation.
I was going to say dumbness.
Right. Well, it's.
I can say it. I can say dumbness.
You could say that, and then but the driving factor, Aaron, is the millions, if not billions, of dollars that the Iranian regime is spending right here in the United States to buy news coverage for itself.
Oh.
And point in case, there was a rumor going around that Elon Musk had met the Iranian ambassador to the UN, Iranian, in New York. And when we looked at it, it was like, okay, so what was the source of news? And it was New York Times. Oh, okay, that's a big one.
Yeah.
So who wrote the article? And the article was written by a reporter that has very, very, you know, dirty ties to the Iranian regime. She was sent outside to basically become a mouthpiece of the Iranian regime at New York Times. And then you read the article, and what was the source of who actually said that this meeting happened? You read it, and it's like, oh, there's an Iranian regime official who had told this reporter that we had this meeting. So New York Times publishes, you know, the headline, the article that this thing happened, and then all of the people who are, you know, excited about the fact that the new administration is gonna go back to maximum pressure get very disappointed that, oh no, they're going back and talking to these people already. And then, you know, 2 days after that, which I think was yesterday, the Iranian regime, because it cannot get any close to having negotiations with the United States, keep in mind the thugs that go to the street and kill people for the Ayatollah, they are driven by the fact that, you know, we are the same, or they are the same people who are fighting the great Satan, the United States. And if they find out that the master is having negotiations with the Satan, guess what? They're going to lose, you know, their motivation to oppress people. So in its nature, the Iranian regime, it either can maintain, you know, its dictatorship through the thugs that it hires to oppress people, or it can, you know, drop everything and come to the negotiation table. So this regime announced yesterday that no, we never had this meeting, and this meeting was false news. So they are doing all of that. They are spreading rumors about us that, you know, they are still trying, you know, labeling us as terrorists.
The good news is, if they didn't see you as a threat, they wouldn't spend the, you know, they wouldn't waste their time. So, you know, in a strange way, being being maligned by them, it tells you that you're doing a good job.
Must be doing something right.
Must be getting closer.
Yeah.
You know, one more point.
Yes, but hold that thought, Fred. You're a casualty of time. But we'll pick up with Fred on the other side of the break. Be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I need a sign. Let me know you're here. 'Cause my TV set just keeps it on.
And true to form, I have remembered where we're supposed to be. Okay, that's not true to form. Usually I forget. Fred, your thought.
Yes, Bill, that was a really good question. That topic of the Iranian activity in USA itself, it can expand on that a lot. When you look at the Iranian government, they're exporting, not only they're exporting the old, also, other thing they're exporting to, like USA and Europe, their agents also. Therefore, they have a strong network that practically when they're sending those agents, for example, in the United States, they get positioned in our universities, in media, and like the example my friend Hamid mentioned. Therefore, they will do practically this kind of activity to provide misinformation. But overall, their goal is practically they're trying to advertise that misinformation that there is no alternative in Iran, and therefore the Iranian government is the only alternative, and it's better to, even though Iran, it's better to make a deal with them. And that's why they're putting a lot of money in the USA. And unfortunately, if we look at the history, like during the Obama administration, I think you're familiar with that, more than 500 that based on that negotiation, they sent 500 people from Iran to get a green card, and they are eligible to get from the green card to become citizens. Therefore, these are the problem you're facing as an Iranian American, that that we'll see in the United States, practically that line of appeasement is opening all this opportunity for the Iranian agents to be practically to provide all this kind of disinformation in the United States. And I'm hoping next administration to look at more in this practically to more in this part of the Iranian activity.
Yeah, and the other part of that is there are a fair amount of Iranian students that come over here for an education and have no ill designs on the United States, and when things like that happen, they send these kids over and create problems. It kind of gives everybody a black eye. So, they had there were reports during the election that they had sent assassins over to kill Trump. And, those kinds of reports certainly don't do the Iranian resistance any good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And still we know those more than 500 students who they came during the Obama administration, and they are active. And they are practically, what you mentioned, they are providing a lot of misinformation through the social media in the USA, and they are very active.
Yeah. Well, with our open border, I wouldn't think that it would be difficult for them to send people over here clandestinely. You know, so many of them, I think they call them gotaways. You got to wonder how many have come into our country and are, you know, basically sleeper cells waiting for the right opportunity to create problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right, Bill. And again, what this all boils down to is that, again, what was just a Iranian problem, what was just a problem for Fred and me and our families back in Iran and millions of others, has now become a problem for everybody.
Sure.
And the solution remains the same, though. The solution remains democratic change in Iran by the people of Iran. And that is why it makes it extremely important for everybody to make sure that the new administration goes further than before in supporting the right policies. You know, there should not be a one-party system in Iran. There should not be, you know, spread of Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran with the help of billions of dollars of oil revenue that they are getting. So put the pressure on them. You know, people of Iran will prevail. I know that, you know, I have been saying this over and over in every place that I talk about the revolution in Iran. In 1978, I remember the winter of 79, I should say. Or actually, no, it was the winter of 78, which led to the February 79 revolution. That winter, I was in Tehran, and the oil refinery workers went on a strike to put the last, you know, straw on the camel of the dictatorship to break that, you know, the camel's back. And because of that strike, there was a huge shortage of gasoline and kerosene. Back then, you know, the heaters in the cold winter were mostly by kerosene. And I remember that day after day, there were lines of few hundred people in every neighborhood trying to get a little bit of kerosene for the heaters at home. And I was one of them in those lines. People were smiling in those lines. People were not mad that the, you know, workers had gone on strike, and people were willing to suffer a little bit so that they would get rid of the dictatorship. Now, it's the same exact thing right now. People of Iran, even if there is a little bit of pressure on them, which there wouldn't be, you know, putting, you know, maximum pressure on the oil sales that Iran should not be doing is not going to put pressure on the people. But even if there was, people of Iran have proven that they are willing to take it so that they would get rid of the dictator, the nation that, you know, has shed lives of over 120,000 of its kids for the fight for freedom. That's the number of people who have lost their lives fighting the Ayatollahs the last 40 years. A wow. Nation that is willing to pay that kind of a price is definitely willing to, you know, suffer a little bit more by the shortage of gasoline or what have you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been going on for such a long time, and when were you the? You guys were really close at one point. Things were very much at a tipping point.
Yeah. So we definitely have been very close a number of times, mm-hmm. and what has happened more than anything else is that the brute force that the regime has brought upon the people has been, you know, has not been condemned properly by international community. Instead of, when we were out talking about the 2019 uprising, which brought the regime to the brink of collapse, 1,500 people, at least 1,500 people, got killed in the streets. There is yet to be a call for international investigation to that uprising from any country in the world. That's pretty much siding with the dictators, with the Ayatollahs, and not doing anything. I know we have talked about the 1988 massacre of 30,000 political prisoners in Iraq. And from 88 up until last year, there was no international action against Iran. And the action last year was basically just a report by the outgoing rapporteur on human rights in Iran at the UN, which was basically just a report. No action has been taken against the Iranian regime for any of the atrocities that they have done. So until the international community takes punitive actions against the Iranian regime, we're going to just keep on coming close and try it again and keep on coming close and try it again. And the road is going to be hard and long for us. But unfortunately, that's the only way to achieve our own freedom, you know, by shedding our own blood and using all of our own resources.
Tell me this. There is, like in the U.S., we did see in this election a real shift with a lot of our youngest voters back to, kind of common sense values. And they broke in a large way for Trump, which was why the DNC had said almost a year ago that they weren't going to spend any money on get-out-the-vote activities like they have in the past, because they were concerned that the new voters and the low 20-somethings were going to vote for Trump. What do you see in your country, the people who actually live in your country, not just the ones helping you outside, but where is the youth and the old, like, who's on board and who's not? Do you have the same kind of weird demographic like we do?
No, the kind of demographic that we see here is, you know, the demographics within a democracy. People still have the right to go and vote and, you know, bring about the change that they want, no matter how much, you know, the polls run by the other side shows that this is not going to happen.
Right.
People go and vote and it happens. In Iran, keep in mind, it's a dictatorship where the vote does not matter.
True.
People are voting by pouring to the streets every once in a while and, you know, getting killed and going back home and getting ready for the next one. And the vote of the people in the dictatorship is by the slogans that people shout in the street.
Well, I wasn't so much meaning the actual. My comparison was inartful. I realize they don't get to choose particularly on their vote, but the support. Is the support base, does it go all the way down to the youth, or is it concentrated more in people who remember what life was like before?
Oh, no, definitely. People, the youth are actually the driving force.
Ah, good.
That is putting, you know, the pressure on the government. The young girls, Fred talked about the woman being the leaders, and it's actually the young girls that are the leaders mostly. And they want to push this regime out, and their goal is to have a democratic system, just like what we see in the West, that, you know, has the
sure
all of the rights, at peace with the neighbors, with a capitalistic system that uses the internal resources and is independent on and on its own legs, and you know, being able to take advantage of all the good things that the, you know, the 21st century has brought to everybody. And well, they deserve it, they support it, and they will achieve it.
I think that's awesome. And just for reference, if people go to the page, November 17th, 2024 is the first time we're airing this. It may come again. But on there, I've listed Miriam Rajavi's 10-point plan for future Iran. So her 10-point plan is there and links to more information. And it's really worth reviewing. I found it really inspiring, actually. She's got some wonderful ideas, and I think you're absolutely right to get behind her. We have run out of time, men.
Can you
believe it? It happened again. Darn it. Happens every time. Fred, Hamid, we appreciate you. And we will add the commercial-free archives this afternoon so you can share them far and wide.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for having us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Absolutely. You can find all that at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.